Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. I'm joined again by my good friend Noel. How you doing, Noel?
Very good, my friend.
Now, Noel, this is our 20th episode of the season, and as you know, it's our final episode of season one. But don't worry, we'll be back for season two in a very short time, and we're going to be focusing on bands that have perhaps got more focus around the 90s.
So I think we're going to go with the name Uncharted 90s on that one, aren't we?
That's spot on. Now, to finish off, we've got an absolute corker of an episode. It's an absolute pleasure for us to focus on a band called The Skids. Now, I know you've done, you know, a lot about this band, but the key thing for the episode is we'll do a short bio of the band. But of course, as you know, we're then going to be talking to Richard Jobson, who was the lead vocals, guitar, keyboards and all sorts. That's coming up later in the episode.
Fantastic. Shall I start?
Go for it. Yeah.
So the story starts in 1977. So the late, great Stuart Adamson, who was born in Manchester, but grew up in Fife. And he was a self-taught guitarist. And at school, became mates with Bill Simpson, who plays the bass. They met Richard Jobson, basically got him to come and sing with them and become the singer. And he also wrote lyrics that was quite handy for them at the time. So as you said, we'll be talking to Richard later on. So they're just missing a drummer, really, to complete the band. And they put an advert in the local Dunfermline Press, and they got Tom Callahan on drums. So that was the original lineup. So they started gigging. I think their first gig was August 77. And within 6 months, they'd got a three-track EP pressed called the Charles EP, which got them the attention of John Peel. And that, in turn, led them to do supports for the Clash and the Buzzcocks later that same year. In 78, they signed to Virgin Records. So that was a big thing. And the first single with them was called Sweet Suburbia. They did the first of five Peel sessions, actually, then. So they did two in 1978, and this is the first one was in May 78. And then they supported the Stranglers a few times throughout 78 as well.
They're just about to release, actually, like a double album of all of those Peel sessions.
Well, that's amazing. I think most of the sessions they did were about four tracks. The next single they did was become something of, I suppose, the song they're perhaps best known for around the world, maybe outside the UK, called The Saints Are Coming. So it only reached 48 in the UK charts, and they appeared on Top of the Pops with it for the first time. But
and what was that about then, Noel?
So that was about it's about a friend of Richard's who joined the British Army and got killed in Northern Ireland. So we'll talk to him about that. Yeah, it was later covered as a charity record in 2006 after Hurricane Katrina by U2 and Green Day. Yeah, the song really got profile at that point. Moving to 79, this was their year in the spotlight, really. Their big productive year. They recorded and released two albums and four singles, all of which charted in the top 40.
All in the same year.
Yes. So it was the
I mean,
year.
that's incredible, isn't it?
And of course, their biggest hit, and the one that a lot of people will know, is Into the Valley. That was released in Feb 79. It reached number 10 in the UK and had two Top of the Pops appearances. It's interesting because it was written by Richard, who's, I think he's only about 15 when he wrote it, actually, about a poem called The Charge of the Light Brigade by Tennyson. And there's a little line in there which says, "Into the Valley of Death rode the 600." So he based it around that poem, but also related it back to the British Army experience that we talked about before.
It's one of those songs that is quite upbeat, but maybe the lyrics are a little bit more darker, maybe.
Absolutely. It's one of those songs, it's deceiving almost when you actually read into it and think about it. It's sort of a jolly way, but actually it's not that jolly after all. So in March they released their first album, Scared to Dance. And it's actually, this is when I went to see them. Actually, I saw them the year before, and this is the second time I saw them actually, and I was both at the Marquee. And when they recorded Scared to Dance, Stuart Addison left the recording sessions before it was completely finished, and a session guitarist had to finish off. But when I saw them 2 weeks later at the Marquee, Stuart was back on guitar. So and they were actually supported by the Roots, who were obviously another great band of that era.
Yeah, and what a great venue the Marquee was. I know we've both been there. I know people thought it was all a bit of a sweat box, but genuinely, so many bands went through that venue.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, do you know what? I don't know if I told you this, but I saw the Jam do a secret gig there. Did I tell you that before? So it was when Eton Rifles was out, before their first number one, Going Underground, was about to come out. They played under the name John's Boys, because obviously they were John Weller managed them. And how I managed to get in, I don't know, but I did, and it was really incredible.
Now that would have been great to go to.
Oh
Those
yeah, it
secret
was.
gigs, must have been incredible.
It was. They did a couple of Peel sessions in 79. On the second one in April, one of the tracks was called War Poets. So that's interesting because it's quite a lot of connection there with the things that Richard is very much interested in, the sort of effects of war, and he's very interested in poetry and got involved in spoken word poetry, later in life. So. They then released Masquerade, and then On from there, in September, they released a top 40 single, Charade, and that appeared on Top of the Pops, and it reached number 31. October, they released a second album, Days in Europa, with the beatbox deluxe singer Bill Nelson.
It's
So,
interesting on that album because I looked on the sleeve notes. It said two down, six to go. What do you think that
what?
meant?
I don't know.
I wondered if it was like their contract. Obviously, they'd got Scared to Dance and then Days in Europa, so that was a two down.
Yeah.
And so maybe they had a contract that was for more albums. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, most record labels want to give them, most people one album at a time, then lose them if they're not making any success. So just before they recorded the album, the drummer Tom Callahan left and was replaced temporarily on drums by Rusty Egan, of course, from Visage and so on.
Yeah, Visage, yeah,
Yeah,
okay.
the Blitz Club. In November, Rusty finished and Mike Bailey joined on drums. But the album caused some controversy, actually. The front cover was described by some as being reminiscent of a poster of the 1936 Summer Olympics in Nazi Germany. And some, including John Peel, felt that it might be trying to glorify Nazi philosophy. Yeah, but actually, what Richard said was that that was completely misread. And, they hate fascists anyway. And the song was about undue pressure put on young people or young men to be in a more traditional sense of masculinity. So it wasn't really about it was it looked kind of like a chiseled young man on the front of the cover, but that's it was just really that's what it was aiming at. They had from the album they did have a single, and that single was Working for the Yankee Dollar. Now that reached number 20, and it was also helped by a Top of the Pops appearance. They appeared live on TV actually at the end of 79 and the old grey whistle test. And they played Animation and Working for the Yankee Dollar. Do you remember John Peel used to have a festive 50 at the end of the year for his favourite
I
tracks of the
do
year?
remember that. Yeah, you used to
Yes,
listen to that. Yeah.
exactly. And his festive 50 of 79 included Into the Valley. So in 1980, the original version of Days in Europa. They kind of remixed it all and changed the sleeve because obviously it's because some of the stuff had gone on.
Why
Yeah.
do you think they did that? Do you think they did that because of the it
I
was
don't
just the
know.
sleeve,
I
but
don't
to
know.
remix it as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they clearly weren't happy with the original mix. It must be part of it, and I guess took the opportunity at that time to change the sleeve. And in that year, Bill Simpson, the bass player, left. He was replaced by Russell Webb, who became a long-term collaborator with Richard. And then the single Animation came out from there as well. One of the tracks, The Olympian, was released on a flexi disc. Remember they used to give flexi discs on the front of Smash Hits
I do,
magazine.
but I
Yeah.
remember, was it Pop Art Poem by The Jam was a flexi,
Yes, that's
was a
right.
flexi
Yeah,
disc? Yeah.
it was. And I think
Yeah.
the Faith Brothers had one as well. Newtown, I think Newtown
Yeah.
live version.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then in August, they released Circus Games, which reached 32 in the chart and again appeared on Top of the Pops. And I noticed actually that month that they did a gig at Hammersmith Palais and they were supported by Simple Minds. But it's
Yeah.
interesting though, because Simple Minds, I think the first two or three albums were really great albums and they weren't the commercial stuff that we'd know now. It's almost kind of a synthy thing too. It was really good stuff. But then they kind of then sort of morphed into the more commercial stuff that we know. Yeah. Then they released their third album, The Absolute Game. Now that was produced by Mick Glossop, whose name has come up several times, hasn't it?
It did. Yeah, came up in the on the Passions episode.
It did, yeah,
He did
it did.
Sanctuary, their album.
That's right. So the Absolute Game was their highest charting album, charting at number 10.
Well, that's interesting because that was the tour that I saw them on. I know you saw them earlier, but I saw them in Dunstable Queensway Hall, and it was a
Oh, right, yes.
huge gig, sold out. You know, from what I remember, very quite aggressive as a gig, but still fantastic.
Well, in the latter part of 1980, they released more singles. They released Goodbye Civilian and Woman in Winter. Both reached around 50 in the charts. Well, at the end of the year, they did a load of gigs. I noticed they'd played in Ireland, Netherlands, and Sweden, and they even played a couple of nights in New York, actually. So they got about a bit. And moving on sort of from there into the next few years after that, actually, this covers. So Mike Baillie left the band, but he would later join for the reunions that we'll talk about. Stuart Adamson went off and started Big Country, a band which we all know. He included the guitarist Bruce Watson, who would later join the Skids for the reunions onwards. Following Stuart's sad and untimely death in 2001, when Big Country reformed, the singer was actually Mike Peters from The Alarm. So the Skids were kind of like down to Richard Jobson and Russell Webb. So they began to write some other stuff from there. They did an album called Joy. And having no success for that, they basically dissolved in 1982.
Well, have you heard that album?
I haven't, have you?
It's what I would call a difficult listen,
Oh,
you
really?
know, to
Wow.
I would say so. You know, and it feels like they were probably in that I don't know whether it was like a decline or what, but it was so different to what had come before that I'm not surprised that it wasn't successful.
Well, they then got together and formed a new band, The Armoury Show, but they only had one album in 1985 before they split up as well. Richard then went on, as I mentioned, he did work as a poet, did a few albums reading out poetry, continued as a songwriter, was a television presenter for a while, and most recently as a film director. Now, I saw that one of his films got 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is incredible, really, isn't it?
All right, and what was that?
That was called 16 Years of Alcohol. Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of got a dark subject matter, but
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, that's to get 80% on Rotten Tomatoes is pretty
It's
impressive,
pretty
isn't it?
good. Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, as I mentioned, Stuart was a troubled soul, and sadly, he ended up taking his own life in Honolulu in 2001, having gone missing for several days before that. So moving forward from there, in 2007, Richard Jobson, Bill Simpson, Mike Bailey, along with Bruce Watson and his son Jamie Watson, who'd also come from Big Country, was back with the Skid. They all played with the Skids, basically. They played a 30th anniversary gig, including Tea in the Park. And they did a few gigs in 2009, 2010. Then they went quiet again. In 2017, they did a 40th anniversary series of gigs. And in 2018, they released their first album for absolutely ages called Burning Cities, which reached number 28 in the album chart.
Yeah, I've got that, and that is what I would, to me, that was like, this is back to the Absolute Game type period. He
Brilliant.
managed to find the sound, he managed to get the great songs. There's a song on there called World on Fire, which is a great song.
Then they did something. They did an acoustic album, but then they came back with an album of covers of other people's songs, which was just kind of a bit of a departure. It was called "Songs from a Haunted Ballroom."
Yeah, and actually, there is a great version of Submission, the Pistols song,
All right.
on that album. It's a really good
Oh, that
version of
sounds
it.
great. In March 23, they released another album, Destination Dusseldorf. That was very successful, actually. Got to 36 in the album chart. It's quite a popular album, and really, that's the story in a nutshell. And they're continuing to gig from time to time.
Well, that Destination Dusseldorf, that. The actual title song is a pretty good song.
Destination Düsseldorf, dem deutschen Volk, über cool. Destination
But it's good to know,
All
you know,
right.
that these, from 1977, where this story starts, they've continued going throughout time. Richard Stick, come back to them over various different periods. So it'll be really interesting to chat to him about it.
Right, let's take the opportunity to find out a bit more about the band and have a chat with Richard Jobson. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Could you just start for us by just telling us a little bit about your background, how you came to be a part of the Skids, and so on?
Well, I came from a small rural community in a place called Fife in central Scotland. They call it almost an island. It's surrounded by sea on three sides. So
Oh, wow.
the people of Fife have got a kind of islander mentality. They're very different from people, say, just north of there is Dundee, and south, just south, is Edinburgh. So we're sandwiched between those two big cities. But we're not very like people from Edinburgh, and we're definitely not like people from Dundee. So they're very kind of unique in their own way. Most bands that came out of the punk era came from cities. They came from London, Manchester, Birmingham, Newcastle, Glasgow, Edinburgh. But we didn't. We were kind of a bit of an anomaly. And I was a bit of a punk when I was a kid before punk rock happened. I had an older brother who was a big influence on me. He introduced me to things when I was maybe 12 and 13, like David Bowie, Iggy Pop, who remained my great hero. Bands like MC5, and even stranger things like Captain Beefheart and kind of more avant-garde things. So I had a really good musical taste from very early on in life, whereas my mates were all listening to Slade or worse, maybe even Genesis. I was listening to Iggy Pop and MC5 and Captain Beefheart, So I was already, before punk rock happened, I think I was already a punk. And I stumbled on two guys called Stuart Adamson and Bill Simpson at a concert in a place called Dunfermline. And the main band was Bebop Deluxe, and they had gone to see them. I hadn't gone to see them. I hadn't gone to see the support band, who were called Doctors of Madness, who were a kind of proto, almost comic book punk band led by a guy called Kid Strange, who remains my friend to this day. So I had gone to see them. I was a big fan of them. I like bands like Alex Harvey a lot, because I like, and obviously Iggy Pop. So I like frontmen, and these were the really great frontmen. And Bebop Deluxe wasn't quite to my taste. It was a bit too kind of guitar-y and rocky, and I don't really like rock music. So they met me at the gig, and they told me they were thinking about starting a band because of this new thing that was happening in London called punk. And this was just late 76, and they're looking for a singer, and they said, "Can you sing?" I went, "Nope." "Can you dance?" I went, "Nope." He said, "Perfect. You've got the job." So that's how I got the that's how I passed the test. But I looked like the real thing. I had the right attitude, and I had an armory of good taste in music, whereas most other people were still listening to kind of, pretty crappy things. Like I say, at my school, even people were walking around with Yes albums or Genesis or Pink Floyd. And I was walking around with my hero, Iggy Pop, and strange things like New York Dolls, first New York Dolls album. Certainly MC5 were a big deal to me. And the whole New York thing, I did like a kind of some bands from Europe. I like Neu a lot, the German band from Dusseldorf. I actually thought they were a punk band because the song I heard was Hero by Neu. And I thought, my God, this sounds like a punk band. They're great. And then I saw them. I went to see them in Edinburgh, and they all had long hair and they were into prog rock. And I went, ah, shit. But I kind of like them, though. I think there's something good about Neu, even to this day. They're more in tune with my other band, The Armoury Show, I think, Neu. Skids, definitely not. Skids were essentially at the beginning a punk band who evolved because the people, essentially Stuart Adamson, was an incredibly talented guitar player who had his own unique sound. And he gave us an identity that a lot of punk bands didn't have because they ended up being Ramones copyists or Clash copyists. And we were never that because we had a bit more of a sophisticated sound, I think. And also my lyrics were very different from what everybody else was writing about. I remember Wilco Johnson, we played with him in Edinburgh for Dr. Feelgood, and he said, "What the hell are you singing about?" Because essentially a pop song is about a boy meets girl, boy splits up with girl, and boy gets girl back again. I mean, oh, get lost. We're a new generation, and we embrace a different kind of lyric. And that inspiration came from maybe Patti Smith, bands like Television, obviously David Bowie, using more interesting lyrics, So And that was embedded in me from very early on. So I think by the time punk came along, what I'm trying to say is I was ready for it. I mean, I was only 15, I was still at school, but I was very different from all the people at my school. The kind of people at my school, most of them were idiots, you know, who liked really crappy music, and I didn't want anything to do with them. So I was a bit of a loner, I guess, at the school because my taste, and I looked different too. I looked very different from everybody else.
Just asking, so you mentioned about punk. So when the Skids supported the Clash quite early on, that must have been fantastic for you. Did you get to meet them?
Of course, no, we played with them lots. I mean, essentially, at the beginning of punk, the Skids were pretty much the only band in Scotland, really, of any muscle. And so we got all the gigs. So, you know, when the Buzzcocks came, we got that gig. When the Stranglers came, we supported them. The Clash, obviously. You know, pretty much everybody who came, we got the support gig. And then we started a gig in our hometown. We didn't start it because it already existed. It was called the Kinema Ballroom. And it had been big in the 60s and 70s. David Bowie played there, for example, and lots of kind of heavy metal bands like Black Sabbath and Zeppelin and things. And it kind of disappeared off the circuit. And we re-engaged with the people that owned that venue and started to put bands on there, you know. And the primary deal was that you came, we paid you. But we got the support gig, so it worked a treat for us. We got the Clash there, we got the Vibrators, the Damned, and Susie and the Banshees were meant to be there, but they split up the night before in Aberdeen. So you know, so all of those people I connected with very early on when I was very, very young, and retained the friendship with them. You know, I'm still very good friends with Hugh Cornwell, for example. He wrote a song on the new Skids album and the new Armory Show album. So we're still pretty close. I'm still very close to Jean-Jacques Burnell. The Buzzcocks, I was never that close to. We played with them, but I always had problems with Steve Diggle. But Severin from the Banshees was my flatmate for 3 or 4 years. So, and the guys from the Pistols, apart from Lydon, who I don't like, but Steve and Paul are still my mates, you know. So it's interesting that from that era, the Skids would be regarded as a band that came in the second wave. But actually, we were pretty much around at the very beginning. So I don't think people are aware of that. And also, when they met me then, I was just so young. You know, I remember Joel Strummer asking me, "What age are you?" I said, "I'm 15." And he went, "Oh my God, you're a real punk." And I laugh about that a lot with Andy Blade from Ether because Andy was at school like I was. You know, we were these feral kids who were still at school, but we were in these bands. But we had something to say, you know, about the world around us, and punk embraced that. I mean, even in the right in the early days, I remember hanging out with Sid Vicious, who was actually a really nice guy. He gets a lot of bad press, and he's a bit comic book because of his behaviour and the tragedy, of course, of his death. But actually, he was very sweet, and he was very kind to me always. But I think it was because I was just a kid, you know, I was just this little kid wandering around the King's Road and stuff in London, and so they kind of took me under their wing a bit. So I really feel that at least I was in amongst it all at the very beginning.
So were you in that? Was punk in? Were you staying in Scotland? Were you coming down to London? What was the dynamic between the two scenes?
Well, I mean, London was part of my life in some ways because my father was originally from there, and well, his mother lived there, sorry. So I used to visit London a lot as a kid. But I mean, the first time I came down to do with punk, me and my friend, this guy, I won't say his name in case I get him in trouble, but he was a bit of a thief and he stole a motorcycle, and it was an old Czechoslovakian bike. It's either MZ or CZ, I can't remember. They're called Awful Bike 125, and we had enough money to put fuel in it to get to London because we wanted to get leather trousers made. You couldn't get them in Scotland. So both of us were 15, didn't have a driving license, obviously, no tax, hadn't passed a test of any kind. And we drove all the way down the A1 in this motorcycle, got to London, got to the King's Road, got our leather trousers made in Beaufort Market, went across the road to Malcolm McLaren's shop, and that's where we met Sid. And he told us he was playing drums with Susie and the Banshees that night at the 100 Club. So we stayed and went to see that famous gig with him playing drums, Susie doing the Lord's Prayer, and they became my friends, you know. And then I remember Sid saying, do you want to sleep on the floor of my squat where I live? I went, nah, mate, we're going to get on the bike and go back to Scotland. So we came all the way down, got our trousers made, and then basically drove all the way back up again. But
wow.
London very much was part of my life. Yeah, that was it. That's where the action was. And Manchester. Manchester was a big deal. You know, we used to love going to Manchester, played there with the Buzzcocks. We became friends with the other version of the Buzzcocks, which became Magazine, played with Slaughter and the Dogs, you know. I think we played Rafters one night, and a band called Warsaw supported us. It was their first
Joy Division. Yeah.
Who became Joy Division, and yeah, they were absolutely terrible. I mean, I'm a big Joy Division fan, but Warsaw were shocking. They were so bad. And I became pals with Ian as well. So, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people ask me, was there a lot of competition in the bands? And I said, it wasn't like that. I think everyone was very supportive of each other, and it didn't feel competitive. The bands never slagged each other off unless you were a complete asshole. It was journalists who did the slagging, you know. So, and I guess I got my fair share of that because, you know, because I was out there and I was maybe a little bit overly confident in their eyes, that they felt I needed taking down a peg or two. And they were probably right. I don't know. Who cares? I was young. When you're young, do you care about these things? I mean, of course not.
But how did the Skids get their name then? How did that come about?
I don't know, actually. I'm often asked that. And I think, you know, the band were, you know, political with a small p, I think, at the early days. Well, actually, in the early days, we were political with a capital P because Stuart wrote most of the words in the early days. And he was, you know, he was kind of ferociously left-wing. I mean, everybody in Scotland in those days was left-wing. There was no such thing as a Tory. You know, everyone was, it was like living in Eastern Germany in many ways. I remember the first time I went to East Berlin and I was in West Berlin. Then I went over to East Berlin. I felt more at home in the East because I said, this is just like what it's like in Scotland. But it was, you know, I think it probably was born out of the politics of the band in the early days. And to be on the Skids was, you know, to be in a difficult place, you know. So that's how we took the name. I think other people think it's about, you know, just ridiculous things. But I think essentially it was about that, you know, being Skid Row, trying to put the brakes on something that was heading towards a disaster, all these kind of things. I mean, it can be interpreted in many different ways.
That's interesting because you talked about the Stuart writing a lot of the lyrics. I was sort of under the impression you wrote quite a lot of the lyrics. So did you sort of take over? Did you take turns?
Yeah, I took over. Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, Stuart wrote all the words, and they were all very social realist style words. You know, about the environment we came from. I explained to you that Fife is a bit of a kind of rural backwater in some people's eyes, not in ours, but in other people's eyes. And he wrote about that. He wrote about the gangs that were going. I mean, the east of Scotland doesn't suffer from the sectarian thing that the west of Scotland comes from. And a lot of English people don't really understand that. It's in the west, they have this kind of Protestant Catholic thing. In the east, it's not a big deal. I'm Catholic by culturally, but the three other members of the band were Protestant. So it never bothered us and we weren't into that kind of thing. But there were a lot of gangs. They weren't so much football related. They were just tribal in the sense of the small areas they came from. But they were very violent. And being a punk was, you know, it was a dangerous thing because you looked different. And it was a very alpha male macho environment. So if you looked, you know, in any way different to that very traditional male thing, you were a target. So it was difficult for us, but I think we were tough little kids, quite feral. And so Stuart kind of reflected a lot of that into his writing. My writing has always been a bit more abstract. And I think, again, that comes from the combination of influences that were a big deal to me, as I say, from even more avant-garde things like Captain Beefheart mixed with Patti Smith, Tom Verlaine, the kind of books I was reading, William Burroughs, a lot of poetry I was reading was all a little bit more obscure and poetic and Stuart's words were much more a punch in the face. So they were very different. I mean, the last thing that Stuart wrote, no, not the last, he wrote Charles, for example, our first ever single was written by Stuart. And that's a really wonderful song. Still stands up. The lyrics to this day still stand up quite strongly. But I think the last lyric he might have wrote would have been Sweet Suburbia. And that was him having a go at trying to be a bit more obscure. And I think it was just total gobbledygook. I mean, my words hopefully have got some kind of meaning. And that had no meaning whatsoever. That was a ridiculous song. And the song that came after that was much better. That was A Sense of Coming. And now we're into when these were my words, and I felt more committed to them, should I say.
Yeah, I mean, I know I read that your a lot of the stuff is influenced by your experience as well. Like your friend, I think, who was in the army, got killed in Northern Ireland. I think The Saints Are Coming is about that, I believe.
Well, Into the Valley is about that too. So is
Yeah.
Melancholy Soldiers from Scared to Dance, Sense of Coming. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the songs were about that. I mean, where we came from, the British Army recruited quite heavily because they knew a lot of the people just above my age, maybe 16 to 18, were never going to get jobs in heavy industry because they were all closing. So the only choice, and I'd use that in inverted commas, was the army. And they just thought they would become engineers or mechanics or something. But of course, what they did was train them for 8 weeks and send them to the north of Ireland to walk down into a very hostile environment, maybe in West Belfast or where they weren't wanted, and were seen as occupiers. So they were very naive about all of these things, and they had a terrible, terrible time. Some of them didn't come home, the ones I knew, and some did come home, but they were very bigoted, especially against the Catholic nationalist community. And of course, I'm from a Catholic heritage. So it was difficult for me to listen to the things that they said, so it was they were definitely traumatized. So I wanted to try and reflect that in the songs. And as I say, the early ones were Melancholy Soldiers. Into the Valley was essentially called Depersonalized at the beginning, which is not the catchiest of titles. But our producer on Scared to Dance changed that and molded it into the Into the Valley that you both will know now, and Sense of Coming, which really, in a funny kind of way, outside the UK. I mean, it for the people that are aware of who we are, I'm not saying there's huge amounts of them, but Into the Valley is probably the one they recognise the most. But beyond these shores, it's not Into the Valley. It's A Sense of Coming because of the U2 and Green Day cover
Oh, the
version.
cover, yeah, for
Yeah,
Hurricane Katrina, yeah.
and that's huge because it went to number one practically in every country on the planet. So that's what we're best known for. Like, we've just been in Australia, and when we played The Sense of Coming, the place just went bananas, So when we played Into the Valley, they liked it, but it wasn't such a big deal as it is here in the UK or in Ireland. So, and in fact, Sense of Coming is bigger in Ireland anyway now because of U2. So it's really interesting. I mean, The Sense of Coming has been covered by so many bands. It's almost every week I get sent another version of that song having been covered, then some of it is just like ludicrously bad, and some of it's actually really good, so it's great. And a lot of people like to use it in short films or documentaries or whatever. And Because they get in touch with me directly because they don't want to pay for it. So if I like the subject, I say, fine, it's cool. It's absolutely cool. I cried to my daddy on the telephone. How long now? Till the clouds don't roll and you come home the line well. But the shadow still remains in your descent, your descent.
You mentioned about poetry as well, and I think I read that as well as the experience of your friends in the army, Into the Valley was also had some reference to Tennyson's poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, as well. And it looks like you over time have become, well, you've been influenced by poetry a lot, and in fact, I think you did some poetry readings as well later on as you went as
I
later on in
did,
life.
yes. No, I did lots of, and still do. And I released with Bill Nelson. I released a poetry spoken word record on his label, Cocteau Records, and with my friend's label in Belgium in the late 70s and early 80s, at Crepuscule, the Belgian French label. I released two or three spoken word records, and it's still something I like doing because I've released lots of books now. I mean, released. If that's the right term, I've written lots of books and fiction, and I'm starting to do that now, put music underneath them and release them as audio books, which is going to be a big thing for me next year. So yeah, that thing's never left me. I mean, I still love it, and I'm a voracious reader. People say to me, what do you need in this life? And I said, well, not much. A book or a piece of music makes me a very happy person. And they're pretty cheap still. Music is too cheap, and books, they've kind of been locked at the same price for an awful long time. And these are the things that make me happier. If you were to say, would you like your own helicopter or Ferrari or whatever? It's like of no interest to me whatsoever. I've just treated myself to a new guitar because I play guitar in the Armory show, but I sold all of my guitars to buy it. I've always wanted a Gibson Les Paul Custom, one from the 1970s. And I've got one now, but to get it, I sold all of my guitar collection just to buy this one, and it's a beauty. So, I'm actually, I don't want to sound like a tight Scotsman here, but I've been quite frugal with things, and there's not much you need. And these are the things that give me great pleasure still.
So did you know that when you wrote Into the Valley that it was going to become a the hit that it was?
Oh God, no. No. I mean, that would be too arrogant. Absolutely not. I mean, I knew straight away after we were on Top of the Pops with Into the Valley that my life had changed because you recorded Top of the Pops on a Wednesday and it went out on a Thursday night. And we recorded it in London, and I'd been very ill that day. I have a health condition, I'm epileptic, and I'd been very sick. And so Stuart was going to cancel our performance, and the people from Virgin Records went into a meltdown going that we can't cancel, this is a big deal. So we couldn't rehearse because I was too sick. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, listen, let's just do it and we'll just go for it. Just go for it. Let's just go mad. And that's what happened. If you look back on that performance on Top of the Pops, it's pretty mad. And we didn't think anything of it. We got back to Scotland, and on the Friday we did what we normally do is we met up in the late morning, went to our rehearsal space, which was in this dingy little damp garage. And we got there, and there must have been 300 or 400 school kids outside, all 14, 15, 16 years old, all waiting for us. And we were like, what the hell is this? And this is from the performance of Top of the Pops the night before. And then I was walking down the road later, and there was a little Italian cafe we used to go to and have a what we called a frothy coffee in those days. You posh boys would call it a cappuccino now, of course.
Yeah.
And we'd go and have a frothy coffee. And as I was walking down the street, somebody rolled their window down. They went, "You're a fucking wanker." And I went, "Oh." And that was because of them, seeing me on Top of the Pops. And then as I walked down the street, it just kept on happening. Not always derogatory, I might add. Some of it was actually rather sweet. But so you knew something had shifted, and every gig after that was sold out. We went from playing as a, pretty much a support band. I mean, we were a support band to the Stranglers for 2 years. I mean, it was a long haul with the Stranglers. And in fact, I ended up singing with the Stranglers when Hugh got put in prison. So I'd do the Skids and come back on and do the Stranglers. So we had a huge connection with them, but we'd never really been a headline band. And then suddenly we were. And that was quite daunting, suddenly from, because it's cool being a support band. I actually still like doing it now. We've just done a couple of support things, and the pressure's not on you. You can just go and have a bit of fun. We just did a gig in Belfast a few weeks ago with Stiff Little Fingers, and that's their hometown, so it's always going to be their gig. And they're great songs. And the Damned, so that is Stiff Little Fingers, the Damned, and us. But I think we have a carefree attitude to it, as in we're going to go on and be as good as we can be. But the pressure's off us because it's we don't have to, in these people's eyes, we don't have to be amazing, but we want to be, So it's a great thing. But so suddenly, when you're a headline band, it changed, and I had to become, from my own kind of feral madness, I had to kind of calm down a bit and try and work out a new way to communicate with a much larger audience.
You were actually the first ever band I saw live, actually. So this was at the Marquee in 78.
Oh yeah,
Yeah, and it
that's
was
where we recorded Albert Tatlock that night.
yes, exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
TV stars. That
Yeah.
was amazing because I didn't know that song when I went to the gig, and everyone was going crazy for it. In fact, I saw you again at the Marquee after Into the Valley was out, which now amazes me because I think you must have been on Top of the Pops by then. But I didn't have a ticket; you couldn't get a ticket. You had to queue in the street to get in. So surprised that actually I could even get in. But there you go. Yeah, those were great times.
Oh, they were. I loved the Marquee. It was one of my favourite gigs, and it was really interesting in those days because I was so young. A lot of the venues we played would not allow people my age to come into them. So I really, because I was more bullish and maybe a little bit more aggressive than the other members of the band, I demanded that they did matinees, which was quite a new thing. There was a club in Liverpool that did it called Eric's. And then that's what sparked it in my head. We should do matinees. So we ended up doing them every single gig. And it really pissed the other guys off because they're having to do two shows a night. And the Skids have always been and still are a very physical band. They had to do it twice. But I loved doing that because at 5 p.m., as the schools were closed, there'd be a queue for a mile of people trying to change out the school gear into something a little bit cooler and come into a Skids gig. And we did that right till the very end. I mean, the last tour we ever did before Stuart left, we played in schools all over the country. So, for example, if we were playing in Sheffield, we would hire a flat back truck and get gear and play it on the truck and go to a school that, with the permission of the headmaster or headmistress, and play at lunchtime. And then, it was
Wow.
amazing. I mean, it's got, looking back on it, it would have been for a lot of those 12 and 13-year-olds, it would have been like the first time they ever saw a band, and they would have seen you on maybe Top of the Pops the night before, and suddenly there you were, in their schoolyard playing for 40 minutes or something. It was great fun. I had a dodgy title, which doesn't really stand the test of time, Skids for Kids. That's not good. We I think we had the right kind of intention, but as I
Yeah.
say, it used to drive the other guys mad. I think it was important, it's part of the values of the band, and I made them do it. It was that, or I wouldn't do the other show, so they had no choice.
I wonder if it's general, you've got, because you've had so much longevity and you've got a lot of fans that have stayed with you right the way through their years. I wonder if that had, helped support that.
Well, it has, because I'll give you an example of that. We played Brighton, a place called the Concord down in Brighton. It's a great gig, and it's packed. And this is like not that long ago. And after the show, I always come out and meet people. It's a very important part of the whole thing. You've got to, and I want to. It's not like you've got to. I want to do it, but a lot of bands don't do it, I might add. But I feel it's part of the show, so I come out, and there was a bunch of guys, about 10 of them, all hanging about by the door afterwards, and they went, "Oh, hi. We didn't come in there. We just wanted to have a chat with you." And I said, "Hey, let's go for a walk." So we all went a walk along the Brighton Pier, and they were telling me they were exactly those kids at one of those schools who never got a chance to see us, because by the time they were able to go to concerts, we didn't exist anymore. But we'd be the first band they'd ever seen, and maybe Masquerade was the first record they ever bought or something when they were kids. And it was great to hear about their lives. Some of them have had really nice, successful, happy lives, and unfortunately, some of them haven't. Their lives have been tarnished with drugs or alcohol or whatever, and have been a bit tougher. But it was great to hear their story as well, and that's an important part of it for me. I do get really frustrated with a lot of the other bands from this particular genre of music and that era, who really just see it as a very cynical way to squeeze a couple of quid out of people. I really don't like that, because you've got to have some values left, and that's not mine. And you can tell the ones that do that, and it's horrible. It's horrible to watch, because they just go through the motions. To come to a Skids gig now, I talk a lot, tell stories like the stories I'm telling you today. I mean, most of it's so I can get my breath back, I might add, but nonetheless, it's got much more of an all-encompassing show than just going through the motions of playing the music, because I don't think that's enough. I think it's got to be more than that.
So we're going back to, back in the day, you had quite a lot of John Peel sessions, I think 4 or 5 sessions. So, I mean, what did that impact have on the band?
Well, it freed us to be more inventive, because with the Peel sessions, there was no hard and fast rules. You could do really whatever you wanted, and I think we wrote The Saints Are Coming specifically for a Peel session. I think Tatlock was written on a Peel session, or TV Stars as you call it,
Yeah.
and we wrote that essentially on a Peel session, and we did lots of inventive things, a bit out there. I mean, it was funny, I was talking about Peel sessions today because I was listening to one today by The Fall, and they did loads of them, Marky Smith doing his thing, and it was just amazing, really, the bands that got an opportunity to express themselves through those Peel sessions. So yeah, I mean, it was because the Skids weren't just as, like I think I said at the very beginning, we weren't just a straightforward 1, 2, 3, 4 Ramones Clash copyists. If you look into the albums like Scared to Dance or Days in Europa, they're quite inventive in places, and there's lots of little strange things going on, which you wouldn't normally associate. You would never get that on a Buzzcocks album, for example, or even a Stiff Little Fingers album. So the Skids were a little bit artier, maybe, than we were given. I don't know, we weren't given much credit for that. I think the title we were given was a Thinking Man's Oi Band, which I really never liked. So I didn't like that at all. And I always thought we had a bit more going on than that. But I mean, you think about the lyrics to Masquerade, it's talks about Guernica, the town that Picasso painted, which Franco's fascists bombed with the help of the Germans during the Spanish Civil War. That's not bad. That was written when you're 16, 17 years old. You managed to get Guernica into a pop song that people dance to and sing along to. So you're always trying to be, I don't know, just push it as far as you can without it being ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, I'm quite proud of that actually, in retrospect. My songs, I mean, I don't think you could, if you went through all the Skids lyrics and music, I don't think you'll ever find some romantic love song in there. I think Stewart was a bit like that. I think, because if you think of what he did with Big Country, he kind of, his thing became much more romantic and, idylls that he would sing about, like a Scottish landscape or something, which all were all metaphors for obviously something more emotional. So that was never my kind of thing. I wasn't a fan of Big Country, so it wasn't my kind of music. It was too prescribed, whereas I felt the Skids were, we had something edgier going on, both musically and lyrically, and I tried to take that into my second band, The Armory Show, to no great success, unfortunately. But in retrospect, I worked with the two greatest guitarists that came out of Scotland, Stuart Adamson and John McGeoch, two incredible talents. And at the time, there was nobody like them. They were very individual styles. And you look at John McGeoch's work with Magazine, Susie and the Banshees, Armory Show, and of course, Pill. It's truly amazing guitar work. And I think Stuart's work with the Skids was amazing. And obviously, as a songwriter with Big Country, phenomenally successful and probably more mature in his songwriting, just not for me. I mean, I don't say that with any kind of envy or bitterness. It's just not my kind of music.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Because I live in Spain now, actually. The Franco thing is massive here. When I learnt about that, it is really interesting. Under the nearby city where I live, Almería City, there's 4 kilometers of tunnels that people built just to escape the air raids and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
it's.
yeah, of course. I mean, and lots of people came from the kind of from Scotland and the north of England and the south of England who opposed fascism and went there and fought, for, the Republicans. And it was an extraordinary thing. I mean, they nearly won, but they were too busy fighting amongst themselves. And that's what toppled them in a way, because it would have knocked out Franco. But there you go. And I mean, I remember playing with the Skids in a bull ring in Spain, and just after Franco died, and it was still very weird, And so we've always been fairly, strong in our wording of being anti-fascist. Unfortunately, I think with Days in Europa, the sleeve was misunderstood, and what I was trying to talk about in that album, and it was put in that particular category. It's a bit of a myth that the sleeve was banned, because that's not true. It never was. But they did a second mix of the album because they didn't like Bill Nelson's mix, because the guitars weren't, up high enough in the mix. So both copies of that album were always available. The only copy that I ever have is that one. I love that
Yeah,
sleeve, and
the original, yeah.
I love the songs. I don't like the other version. I don't like the sleeve either, even though I helped design it, and I'm very proud of that album, which of course in start touring it in the 6th of November, playing it in its entirety, which is a very exciting thing. Never done that. Well, we did when we did the Days in Europa tour in 1980, end of 79 into 1980, we decided to do the whole album and nothing else. We did 2 nights, and then we changed the set because Scared to Dance and Days in Europa came out in the same year, 1979, and people had just got used to Scared to Dance, and we weren't playing any of it. So we weren't doing Saints Are Coming, we weren't doing Into the Valley, we weren't doing Charles, we weren't doing any of those songs, and we were only playing Days in Europa, which nobody had really heard. So people were, and we were playing in big crowds, much bigger venues. So people were mighty pissed off that were coming to the show. So we had to change it. But this time, I'm thinking, 45 years later, maybe we can play the whole album. So we're going to give it a go. I start rehearsing tomorrow in Scotland, so I'm heading up there tomorrow.
Yeah, so you've got Spirit of Destiny supporting.
We have,
Yeah,
and it's going to
great.
be a nice double bill, I think. So I'm going back down to a four piece with for the tour. So, and we're going to travel light and just give it our best shot, I think. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I get on very well with Kirk. Spirit are good bands, great songs. So big fan. I mean, still have Liberator on my playlist. So yeah,
Great
no,
song.
it's,
Yeah, great
yeah, it's a
song.
great song. Yeah, no, he's a good
Yeah.
guy, and yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great.
So, were you mates with Rusty Egan? Because obviously, he played drums for a short period with the Skids.
I was, yeah, I met Rusty first of all when he played with a band called The Rich Kids, with
Yes.
Glenn Matlock and Measure. And we played with them in Edinburgh, and we became instantaneous friends. And I went down to London, and I used to stay with him. He shared a flat with a guy called Steve Strange, who he started a band called Visage with.
Visage, yeah.
That's right. And they had a club in the West End of London in Covent Garden called The Blitz.
Yeah.
So I used to go along there, and I stayed at Rusty's place. And then some nights we would go to see like a treble bill at this late night cinema around the corner from his flat. Off all these Dirk Bogarde movies and obscure European films, very arty. And that's really at the time where I felt I have to be part of London life, and what was available to me in Scotland didn't really mean much to me. Stuart always found that difficult because he wanted a wife and a mortgage and a family and, a calmness in his life. And I didn't. I wanted just crazy chaos and, I think that used to drive him mad, but he was always a hometown boy, as were the other members, and I really wasn't. I didn't really feel like it was my home. I felt everywhere was my home, so I traveled around a lot, did some work in Europe, in Berlin, when the wall was there, stayed there. So yeah, I mean, I was very different from that. I kind of had a taste for something. I think I take it all back to that motorcycle journey I told you about when we came down to buy our leather trousers and met Sid, and I just thought, this is where I want to be, because this is where it's happening. And it was the epicenter of it. And I didn't really have anything to go back to because Stuart had a girlfriend and, he'd already just bought a flat and stuff, which was, seemed so old to me. That's what old people did, bought something and owned it. So, I think that was the beginning of the parting of the waves, really. Yeah, and we never fell out. I don't think he was a difficult guy, but so was I. So, who knows? But
So,
he had these other he had kind of darker issues in his life anyway, that all came out and sadly pointed him in the direction of a tragic end. So it was a very sad day when we heard that he had taken his own life.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, it's still shocking now, to be honest. How, where were you when you heard about that?
At the time, I think I was working as a movie critic for a TV show,
Yes.
and they, you'd go and see previews of movies so you could kind of review them in the early morning, so it'd be before the movie came out at the end of the week. And I was in a movie theater, but you obviously have to. There was very primitive mobile phones by that period, but you have to turn your phone off when you're in there watching the movie. And when I came out, I had hundreds of messages. So I knew something was wrong, but I thought maybe it was closer to home because I hadn't spoke to him for a while. And then I realized it was like lots of kind of horrible, sleazy journalists trying to get a quote from me, as well as people who were just trying to pre-warn me what had happened and stuff. And then people telling me the horror of what happened, that it wasn't, I just presumed it was an accident or something, but obviously it wasn't. It was much more tragic, and yeah, it was pretty awful. But he had undoubtedly been in a bad way prior to that, with alcohol. So strange, because when we were never a band of drinkers, really, it's not really an important thing to us. Certainly that, or definitely not drugs. But I'm not. I mean, I knew he had stuff going on from his childhood and all that, but yeah, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah, very much so. So Change the subject. How did you come up with the name and the concept of the Armoury Show?
I had written a poem called Armoury Show for a compilation of different people's work for that label Pepper School in Belgium, and they released it, and it was about an exhibition in New York in the turn of the century, the 20th century, that brought European art to the East Coast of America for the first time ever. And it was held in the Lexington Armory, and it was called the Armory Show. So it was a moment of change, because American art changed forevermore once they saw Picasso and Monet, Manet, the post-impressionists, then the surrealists and the cubists. You know, the American artists were like, holy hell, what are we doing? We're still doing landscapes and whatever, and these people are out there changing everything. So it changed American art. So it was a moment of change, and I thought that was a really good thing. You know, that, and I love the idea of the show, but I thought if I applied it to the band, it's a moment of change for all of us. John had been a force of nature in Magazine. He's amazing guitar playing in Magazine. Those brilliant albums, Real Life, followed by Correct Use of Soap. I mean, amazing. And I think he's best work was with the Banshees and maybe Juju, the album Juju. So, you know, he's a phenomenal, but he had got himself in a bit of a mess with alcohol and drugs. So we thought we could sort that out, but unfortunately we couldn't. And although we managed to get an album made, which is pretty good, this album, overproduced, no doubt about it, it was never going to work. And I knew that from the first 10 minutes of being, because he just was. You know, it's not that you wanted to control him, but you kind of wanted to save him from himself, and he wasn't for saving. You know, it's not how he saw it, and he, in a sad way, believed in the rock and roll myth that you could be wasted and still be incredibly creative and do great stuff, which is not, it's not the case. It's ludicrously idiotic. So, and John paid the price for that later in life. You know, his body just packed in, and he sadly died. Because you know, he had really punished himself throughout all those years, but he was an amazing guitarist, and I had great hopes for the Armory Show, and I really thought it was going to give me an opportunity to blend songs that have great tunes and interesting words that could be a little bit more inventive in the way we structured them and stuff. And so I've been playing live, because I got asked by a bunch of people who are massive Armory Show fans. And there's not many of them, that's for sure. If I would do it again, and I said, oh, you know, it's the great failure in my life, the Armory Show, so I don't really want to revisit. So they said, well, just give it a go in the rehearsal room. So I went up, and it's a very different experience to the skids, because I play guitar in the Armory Show, and it felt amazing, because the songs, I associate the songs with the Waiting for the Floods album, which is Nick Lawney, who does all Nick Cave stuff now. It's just overproduced. It's too big. It's got that 80s drum sound, and my voice is too like verbose, and you know, everything's just over the top. But underneath it, the songs are actually really good. So I've been played a few gigs and a few festivals and absolutely loved it. Changed the name to the original title of the poem, because in America, Armory doesn't have a U in it. And it wasn't the Armory Show, it was just Armory Show. So I went back to the original title, and I've just finished recording a new album, and it's got something about it. You know, it's a very different thing, because when you do a Skids album, you still have to be very aware of the genre that you want to appeal to. So the songs have still got to have, you know, good tunes. Big choruses is essentially part of the Skids thing, you know, anthemic choruses, and quite tight, you know, 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes. With the Armory Show, you can let them breathe a bit more, you can be a bit more inventive, and you know, no one's going to accuse you of anything other than trying to be creative. So I can take that. So and you know, also with no false humility, I'm completely aware that the Armory Show is not a band that many people are aware of. So it's just a slow thing that might build to something, probably won't, but we'll give it a really good go. The album is working title is Dead Souls, taken from the great Russian writer Gogol, and it's cracking. It's a cracking album. Got a song on there with Hugh Cornwell again, and I've written a lot of the songs with a guy called Martin Metcalf, who was in Goodbye, Mr. Mackenzie, and another band called The Filthy Tongues, amazing songwriter. So yeah, it's got something about it, you know, and I'm really, I think people are going to like it.
So taking you back then to the end of the first phase of the Skids, so Absolute Game, Joy, and then going into that split. What was the lead up to that?
Well, the last gig we did was Hammersmith Odeon, as it was called then, to a sellout audience, and it was a pretty amazing gig. But sure, it was very clearly very, very unhappy, and he was making it clear to us that he didn't really want to be with us. And then we tried to, because he often did that throughout the history of the Skids, disappear and then would return as if nothing had happened. And then we went to Inverness to record this new idea I had for the Skids to turn us into almost the Clash meets the Pogues. You know, it was like a kind of folky, vibrant thing that we were starting to investigate a little bit on Absolute Game with songs like Hurry On Boys. You know, we always liked folk music, you know. I thought it was something that would really work for him. And in a funny kind of way, it's exactly what he did with Big Country, but in a more rocky, melodic way. I wanted to do something a little bit more ferocious. So he just vanished. And normally I would go and say, oh, come on, let's get this sorted out. And we would eventually sort it out. This time I just couldn't. It happened so many times. I'm not sure I cared anymore. You know, I was kind of exhausted with it. So I went on to finish recording what we had started and with Joy. But I mean, the reality of the album Joy is it's got some nice moments on it, but it doesn't have him on it. It doesn't have a guitar on it. So it doesn't really have an identity. You know, it's a series of sketches, I think, rather than a finished album. A couple of great songs in it. Fields, I think, is great. That's where I wanted to take us in that direction.
Oh, shift thy feet, oh, desert one, toll and tug your burden. Even here the sweat will gain the firm belief so Christian. Evil's eye of middle age, ever tender struggle, will once again devour you, carry forth and listen. The urge of man upon whose land guarantees an altar of kindred sand and flowering spring.
And then, as I say, you know, he went into the world of Big Country and did do a folk rock thing, but in a much more mainstream way, you know, than I was thinking. And I've never wanted to be, although the Skids, I guess, in some ways became mainstream because they were so successful. But I've never had any desire to be mainstream, you know. So it was a shame that it had to end that way. And Joy, as I say, it's an album that given more thought, given more time, and with the right kind of energy, I think would have worked. But we ended up, Russell Webb, who was the best player, ended up producing it, and he's not a good producer. Didn't do a very good job. And it's got little highlights, but not enough to make it special.
Wouldn't consider going back and revamping it.
It's an interesting idea. I don't think so. I mean, I think I went back into recording because Youth, my friend Youth, who's a massive producer, the guy based there from Killing Joke, obviously. I bet he's a massive, massive producer. It was him that got me to try again with Burning Cities, which he wrote quite a lot of the songs with me. And that album's got a lot of great energy, which I'm very proud of. And it did incredibly well. We were all shocked by how well that album did. And then I did another one, Destination Dusseldorf, which I think has got some nice songs on it. But like I think I've said to you on many occasions during this chat that the Skids are very aware of the genre they're coming from. And when you're in a genre of music, you've got to be careful how you break out of it. Because if you go too far, like Joy, for example, there's a good example, then people just go, what the hell is this? I don't want that. So you've got to be careful. But you still, at the same time, for your own sake, you've got to be inventive. So I think there's, with both of those albums, they've got both got a kind of nice energy. And they don't have Stuart Adamson, obviously. But I've got, it's funny now because back then, 77, 78, 79, 80, there weren't any Stuart Adamsons or John McGeoch. It was only them two. Now, there's thousands of them. These amazing young guitarists are out there who can. I'm with guys and I just say, oh, have you ever heard the song Waiting for the Floods? And they go, oh, yeah, I love that song. He's like 22 and he just goes, plays it perfectly. And you go, like, oh my God, how can you do that? And they can play John's parts with a kind of elegance. And you go, oh my God, or Stuart's parts with incredible elegance and energy. So, those two guys were unique for the time, but they're not unique anymore. Honestly, it's a new wave of talent. But they might have the talent technically. That doesn't mean to say they're great songwriters, whereas I think Adamson had the power to be a great songwriter. And McGeoch, his contributions to, as I say, to Magazine and Susie and the Banshees, Armoury Show and Pill is, some of the greatest stuff that came out of that whole era, no doubt about it. You like think of the guitar line and The Light Pours Out of Me. It's just so simple. Which he brought into the Armoury Show with songs like Castles in Spain. It's kind of got a similar kind of dirgy riff. Amazing, amazing. Stuart was definitely, he was more into Bill Nelson, Bebop Deluxe. He's a big fan of a guy called Nils Lofgren. He's a bit of a Springsteen head. I mean, he wasn't so much as a punk as I was, I don't think. So his taste was a little bit more formed in rock music than it was, where my thing was probably alternative music, from way back. Still is. I mean, still now, I mean, I still like hearing the dirge of an indie band to a rock band. I mean, I'm just not slightly bit interested. I mean, I liked Fontaine's DC, but they've already, you can see that the way they're carving their songs out is already the establishment's got a hold of them. They're carving songs out that they think people want rather than doing songs that they should do. So there's a big difference between those two things, and you're playing with expectations, and I think it's a massive mistake. So, but it's, they're in charge of their own future.
We've heard it a lot, Richard, on our on the 20, the 20 odd episodes that we've done. I would say more than half of them have had bands that have tried to be, changed by the record company or by the producer, or to fit a mold that and in the end, it sort of led to those bands' decline,
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Armoury Show is a good example of that. We had a manager called Peter Mench. She managed Metallica, Def Leppard at the time, big rock bands, stadium rock bands. And that whole stadium thing was just happening then, remember? So the British and Irish bands that were suddenly involved with that would be U2, obviously, The Police, and then Simple Minds from Scotland, too. suddenly found himself in this vast territory of arenas. And, you know, he tried to cultivate us. He thought we were going to be like the next U2, whereas I was trying to make us like a band that had all the great stuff from Magazine mixed with all the great stuff from the Skids. So, you know, it was a different thing to what U2 were. And, you know, we were a different type of band. But unfortunately, it was just so pompously produced for an American market that it murdered the band. I mean, just because underneath it, when we play the songs live now, the songs are really good. Glory of Love, Castles in Spain. Really come alive when we play them live. And you know, when you listen back to the album, you go, my God, all I can hear is drums and overproduced guitar sounds and, you know, too much bass and my voice sounding like I'm trying to be in an opera or something. It's awful. But the songs were good. Destroyed though by this trying to get us ready for America when we weren't even ready for the UK.
Post the Skids then, you obviously got involved in lots of different things. As we fast forward, how do we then get to the reunions?
The reunions really came from the U2 Green Day, a kind of revisit of Saints of Coming, which was done for the kids who lost their musical instruments during Hurricane Katrina. It was an amazing thing to watch a song that you, the words at least, but you, when you wrote when you were 15, suddenly taking on this amazing power. You know, performed by the two biggest rock bands on the planet. You know, it's like quite something. So we were offered lots of things, and I was always like a little bit more skeptical because I had a life as a filmmaker and a writer, and I'm quite happy in those worlds. So I had never any determination to come back. And also, I didn't want to make an arse of myself, you know, because a lot of the people that I saw coming back, it was pathetic. And then my younger brother, who's in the business, his best friends run a festival called Tea in the Park in Glasgow. And said, they really want you to play just as a one-off thing. So we rehearsed and we had done a Stuart Adamson memorial thing prior to that, which was nice thing to do. And then we played Tea in the Park and we played with Arcade Fire, with their headline band.
Brilliant.
And, you know, we thought nobody would give a shit about us, but it was amazing. It was an amazing thing. I thought nobody would be in the audience because we were on quite early, but they reckon there was about 50,000 people there. So it was quite something. So, yeah, and then Youth, as I said, I told you before, he encouraged me to record. He said, if you record, you might want to play. Give it a go. If you don't like it, you don't have to release it. But I did like it because modern technology suits me as a person better than the old analog technology. Digital technology means you can work fast and, you know, you can chop things around very quickly. And it was the process of the other thing that I hated, recording in shoes. I hated it because listening to drums for days, you know, like, that is painful. And they always waited till the very end to do the vocals, you know, for some stupid reason. And by then you were bored out of your mind. So, you know, I've never had a good experience in a studio until I met Youth. And you record in his house in South London. It's like a four-story house. And then one room was Jesus and Mary Chain, and another room that was the guy from Pink Floyd, and then the floor below was some DJ from Dusseldorf, and then I was recording in the kitchen, with these dog and
Wow.
cats running around, and it had this mad, almost hippie-like energy. I was amazed. I actually loved the experience, so it kind of gave me a little bit of encouragement to maybe do something. Then we released an album, and the album did incredibly well. So we had to go and support it by playing, which I was quite nervous of. But it was great fun. And when the fun's in, I'm happy. When the fun's taken out of it, I'm gone, So it's never must be about more cynical things like money or whatever. It's just got to be about the fun. And then when certain people start behaving in a way where it's not fun, then I just get rid of them, just go, I don't really want to be working with you. So at the moment, as I say, it's just a blast. I never expected to be doing it. I never expected it to be a success. And here we are, it's been a phenomenal success. I remember just before COVID struck that we played the Albert Hall with the Buzzcocks. And it was initially a double bill. The Buzzcocks weren't in a good place at that point in time. They were playing really tiny, grubby venues. But the promoter thought with the two of us, it would double bill, we'll be able to sell it. And it was doing pretty well. Then Pete Shelley unfortunately passed away. And the whole event was hijacked as a memorial to Pete, which is, was the right thing to do, of course. But, it was 5,500, 6,000 people there that night, to watch us. So it was a pretty amazing experience to suddenly go, wait a minute, this is an amazing thing. And it still is. I think the tour that we're doing with Spear, I think most of the dates are sold out, although the venues are not all huge, but most of them are sold out, and it'll be a lot of fun. And I think people are now aware when they come to see us that they get a show. It's a full-on show. There's no hiding behind the songs, there's no shoegazing going on. I take the piss out myself, tell a few funny stories, hopefully funny, and blast the songs out, as if I'm 16 years old again. So, and then at the end of the show, I'm clearly not 16 years old again, but there you go. So it's great. It's great fun. But when the fun part is gone, I'm gone. That'll be the end of it.
How did you feel when Jamie and Bruce last year then m moved on?
Well, I think they've got their own bands, and it was there was a lot I wanted to do that I couldn't do because they're, I mean, big country, pretty much playing every weekend and stuff. So it was only ever meant to be a temporary thing, but it became all the things that we had to do with the skids always had to fit around big country. So we were getting invited to Europe, couldn't play because they were doing something. We got invited to Australia and New Zealand and Hong Kong and the Far East. And couldn't do it because they're playing with their band, so it wasn't acrimonious. It was just like you do your band and I'll see if I can re kind of calibrate this one. So basically, I'm working. The band is the guys I work with the Armory Show, and so which is going to be fun because some nights, we can support ourselves as the Armory Show. So I really want to do that. That's a great night,
Brilliant.
Well, I for one am really pleased that you've carried on. I saw you in 1980 on the Absolute Game Tour in Dunstable, Queensway Hall, and it was
Big
like a
game.
real it was massive, and that was sold out. And I mean, it was pretty aggressive, as I remember.
You were a lot of
But
skinheads were there that night.
yeah, there were. Yeah,
It's now a
I think
Tesco. No, it's now an Asda.
it's yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a tragedy, right? Because it was a great venue, but
It was.
that's another story.
Are you from that area?
Yeah, I was born in Luton, so
All right.
although I'm in Kent now, I live in Canterbury. I'm a Luton Town season ticket holder,
All
so
right.
I go back every game.
Yeah,
But
I'm a massive St. Pauli fan. That's my team in Germany.
oh, Hamburg.
The team from Hamburg, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of football teams use our songs. St. Pauli use Saints Are Coming, Southampton use it, Charlton Athletic use Into the Valley, Dunfermline use Into the Valley, St. Johnstone in Scotland use Saints Are Coming. The New Orleans Saints use the Saints Are Coming. It's amazing, really, the amount of bands. Fortuna Dusseldorf use Destination Dusseldorf as their song now. It's amazing, really, when you go to these games and you hear these songs, being sung by 30, 40,000 people next to you. It's pretty good.
Can I just do one thing, which is what's your greatest memory of your time?
Oh, there's been so many. I mean, probably becoming a parent, I would say. But in creative terms, if that's what you mean, it's probably the sense of coming and what it's become, this kind of global song that has literally nothing to do with me anymore, and it's when I talk to people, like when I'm in Australia or New Zealand or something, they go, "Were you in a band?" And I say, "Yeah, it's all punk band, the Skids," and I've never heard of them. He said, "Did you have any hits?" And I went, "Oh, a couple. One called The Sense of Coming, not the U2 Sense of Coming." And I said, "That's it. I wrote that." Yeah, and they're like, "Oh my God!" So, do you know what I mean? It connects us with the world, that song, which is an amazing thing, because I wrote those words in the local library in Dunfermline, and at that point in time, you have no expectation of anything, and then suddenly, lo and behold, it's a global thing, which is pretty amazing.
It's so good. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, my pleasure,
Thank
mate. So lovely to talk to the two of you. Yeah,
Thank
thank
you.
you.
Okay, see
Cheers.
ya. Ciao.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources, but of course, if you want to add any more details to what we've talked about, correct us on anything, then you can of course contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.co.uk.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, the Uncharted 80s. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.